Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You hang up being there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money from the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
I want to tell you about the first time I was 21 years old and I saw $6 million of cash right in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That's what $6 million looks like. Insane. How the hell can I get this kind of money one day? And the guy who had the $6 million was a Jewish businessman who owned dealerships in San Fernando Valley area. And he gave me an advice at 21 that completely changed the way I do business till today. By the way, if you get value from today's message, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. Here's what this Jewish businessman told me. I said, how is it possible you got this much money and you're in your mid-30s, $6 million cash? He says, Patrick, there's one thing you need to know about Jews. I said, what's that? When one makes money, five make money. I said, what? He says, when one of us makes money in a business, five other Jews make money because we like to make money in groups. I said, so what's the benefit of that? He said, everybody keeps doing business together. He says, too many people, ethnicities, nationalities, cultures, backgrounds, they just want to be the one making money. They don't want anybody else around them making money. And then eventually they wonder, how come nobody wants to go into business with me? Because when you make money, nobody else makes money. So ask yourself the question. Number one, the person you're working for, does he make money and do you make money? And number two, the people that work with you, who report to you, if they give their best, do they also make good money the way you're making money? If the answer is yes, you're in a great place. Go do your part, and eventually you'll make your money like that Jewish mentor shared with this 21-year-old 23 years ago. If you got value from this video, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. And if you've never watched the video, 20 Rules of Money, How Actually Money Works, click here to watch the video, 20 Rules of Money. Take care, everybody.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Well, I say it is frightening, and it should be frightened to the entire American people that he has demanded $10 billion. And if he doesn't get it, then there may be riots this summer. Martin Luther King is nothing but a blackmailer, and he should be arrested for blackmailing because he certainly has blackmailed the United States government.
There's one thing that bothers me, and that, as a Negro yourself, why do you talk so bitterly against Martin Luther King and a lot of these other people of your race?
Well, let me tell you something. I don't put my race before I do my country. Being a Negro woman doesn't matter to me who is a Negro or who is a white person. If they are enemies of our country, then they are certainly my enemies too.
Today's podcast is titled Julia Clarice Brown. If anybody out there knows who she was, give us a call at 619-768-2945, press 1. Julia Clarice Brown, MLK, Reparations and Black Billionaires. That's our topic for today, if you guys care to chime in on it. Um, we'll play Julia Clarice Brown again. If you have any comments, 619-768-2945.
Well, I say it is frightening, and it should be frightened to the entire American people that he has demanded $10 billion. And if he doesn't get it, then there may be riots this summer. Martin Luther King is nothing but a blackmailer, and he should be arrested for blackmailing because he certainly has blackmailed the United States government.
There's one thing that bothers me, and that, as a Negro yourself, why do you talk so bitterly against Martin Luther King and a lot of these other people of your race?
Well, let me tell you something. I don't put my race before I do my country. Being a Negro woman doesn't matter to me who is a Negro or who is a white person. If they are enemies of our country, then they are certainly my enemies too.
Okay, I guess it's still early out there, 10:46 a.m. I guess people start trailing in about 11. So we're going to cover today Julia Clarice Brown, MLK, Reparations and Black Billionaires. And Ms. Brown said that MLK was a blackmailer. What do you think? Was he or was he not a blackmailer? 619-768-2945. And let's see. While we're waiting for people to, you know, get in, because they get in when they get in. All right, we'll skip around and see what we can play for you. Wait a minute. Okay.
I don't think people necessarily understand what happened last week with the Great Make America Great Again hat. What are you trying to do with the message you're sending?
Well, it was really just my subconscious. It was a feeling I had. You know, like, people were taught how to think. We're taught how to feel. We don't know how to think for ourselves. We don't know how to feel for ourselves. People say feel free, but they don't really want us to feel free. And I felt a freedom. And first of all, just doing something that everybody tells you not to do. I just love Trump. That's my boy. Like, you know, it's like so many rappers. You look at a video of Snoop Dogg loving Trump, but then he get in the office and now they don't love him. Like, Trump is one of rap's favorite people,
no,
right?
But we talk about this, that before he was elected president, people in hip-hop, it was an in thing to put Donald Trump in your rhyme somewhere.
Yeah. And by the way, I am in hip-hop, but I'm not just in hip-hop. I'm a black person in a black community, but I'm not just that. I feel like one thing is people try to minimize me to artists, hip-hop, black community. Yeah, I'm always going to represent that, but I also represent the world. When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all? You know, like, it's like we're mentally in prison. I like the word prison because slavery goes too direct to the idea of blacks. It's like slavery, Holocaust Jews, slavery is blacks. So prison is something that unites us as one race, blacks and whites being one race, that we're one, we're the human race. Do you feel that I'm feeling, do you feel that I'm being free and I'm thinking free?
I actually don't think you're thinking anything. I think what you're doing right now is actually the absence of thought. And the reason why I feel like that is because
Kanye, you're entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to believe whatever you want. But there is fact and real world, real life consequence behind everything that you just said. And while you are making music and being an artist and living the life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice. Frankly, I'm disappointed, I'm appalled, and brother, I am unbelievably hurt by the fact that you have morphed into something, to me, that's not real.
Bro, you gotta be responsible, man. Bro, I'm sorry
you
I
gotta,
hurt you.
You got to be responsible.
No, I'm sorry I hurt you, bro.
Bro, your voice is too big. You got
After months of intermittent warfare, fighting in the Congo shows no signs of abating. Regional tensions have intensified with the continuing presence of the Belgian army. Patrice Lumumba, the father of the Congolese independence movement, was recently captured by rebel forces. His condition is currently unknown.
For 75 years, Belgian colonialism dominated almost every aspect of Congolese life. Under the guise of paternalism, Belgium restricted Congolese social mobility, political participation, and educational opportunities. Native workers, no matter how skilled, were not promoted and were paid significantly less than their white counterparts. However, in the mid-1950s, the nationalism sweeping Africa struck a nerve in the Belgian Congo. In 1958, due to rising instability, the Belgians were forced, for the first time, to permit the Congolese to form political parties, which were dominated by local tribes. But none of these could gather national support in the tribally diverse Congo. Only one party, the non-tribal Mouvement National Congolais, or MNC, succeeded on a national scale. Its strength came from the personality and power of its leader, Patrice Lumumba. Patrice Lumumba, who started adulthood as a clerk, was initially moderate on the issues of independence and reform. This changed dramatically at the 1958 All-African People's Conference in Accra, Ghana, where African nationalists met to discuss the creation of an independent Pan-African community. Lumumba's contact with Kwame Nkrumah, the president and founder of Ghana, cemented his beliefs in the need for immediate independence. He came to Ghana a clerk, the head of a little-known party, and left the man who would change not only the Congo, but all of Africa. Just after the conference, bloody riots shook the city of Leopoldville. Beneath the previously calm surface, the Congo had been torn apart. There seemed to be only one way to restore order. On January 13, 1959, King Baudouin of Belgium announced that his country would grant the Congo independence. However, King Baudouin had intentionally named no date. The king planned to hold on to the Congo for as long as possible. But instead, the instability in the Congo increased as nationalist leaders, most notably Patrice Lumumba, pushed for immediate independence. The Belgians recognized negotiations were unavoidable and set a series of talks with the Congolese, the Roundtable Conference, to begin on January 20, 1960, in Brussels. The Belgians expected to take advantage of divisions among the Congolese delegates. Most seriously, the representatives from the southern province of Katanga, which controlled the majority of the country's natural resources and industry, wished to form an autonomous state. However, when the Africans landed in Brussels, they pledged to join together with Lumumba's MNC to secure immediate independence. In addition to Congolese strength, the Belgian position was weak. A strong anti-war sentiment among the Belgian youth, economic instability in the Congo, and political feuds within the Belgian government left Belgium in no position to counter Congolese demands. Independence Day was set for June 30, 1960, and the first ever Congolese national election took place over a week in mid-May. The Congo seemed to have done the impossible. A nation with only 2 years of political experience had elected its own government, dominated by Lumumba's MNC, which had been so vital in ensuring independence. Lumumba himself, now a national hero, became prime minister. Independence Day had arrived without bloodshed or the Katangan secession many had predicted. On this historic day, King Baudouin delivered his speech to the newly freed Congo.
L'indépendance du Congo constitue l'aboutissement de l'œuvre conçue par le génie du roi Léopold II, entreprise par lui avec un courage tenace, et continuer avec persévérance par la Belgique.
But Lumumba was unwilling to let the king praise the evils of Belgian colonialism.
Nous avons connu les ironies, les insultes, les coups que nous devions subir matin, midi et soir, parce que nous étions des nègres. Qui oubliera qu'à un noir, on disait tu, non certes comme à un ami, mais parce qu'elle est vous honorable.
This address, the Tears, Fire, and Blood speech, won Lumumba support in the Congo, but aggravated tensions between his country and Belgium. These tensions worsened when the Force Publique, which thought Lumumba would Africanize the army, decided to mutiny rather than remain under white officers. The force left their barracks and began to harass the wealthy whites. Even though this violence was halted with the election of black officers, Belgium still sent in its army to protect white settlers. Rather than pacifying the Congo, the Belgian presence caused further violence. To the Africans, it seemed the Belgians were attempting to take back the independence given only a week before. Lumumba tried to restore order, but his efforts were stymied by illegal and often unwarranted Belgian intervention. On July 11th, any chance of reconciliation was lost when Katanga finally seceded and Belgium supported the move. Lumumba turned to the United Nations, but Cold War tensions prevented the body from intervening. NATO members were unwilling to harm their ally Belgium by supporting Lumumba. Eventually, a compromise was hammered out in which United Nations soldiers replaced the Belgian troops in every province except secessionist Katanga. There, the UN refused to intervene in the so-called internal affair, allowing the Belgian army to remain and prop up the illegitimate regime. This forced Lumumba to invade Katanga with the force publique. The invasion, combined with his wartime restrictions of civil liberties, convinced his opponents that he had gone too far. Lumumba's chief rival outside of Katanga was Joseph Kasavubu, president of the Congo and leader of the most powerful of the tribal parties. Using an obscure law, President Kasavubu removed Lumumba and many of his ministers from office. Lumumba, in turn, called on Parliament, which removed Kasavubu. Lumumba and Kasavubu found themselves at a stalemate. Several attempts were made at reconciliation, but Kasavubu refused. In this power vacuum, Colonel Mobutu, senior commander of the Force Publique in Leopoldville, seized control and placed Lumumba under house arrest. Hoping to regain power, Lumumba attempted to flee to his center of support in Stanleyville, but was captured by Mobutu's soldiers. The Belgian government arranged for Lumumba to be flown to Elizabethville, the stronghold of Shombe's secessionist forces, ensuring his death. On January 17th, he arrived, bound, badly beaten, and missing his glasses. Now, in front of cameras, he was beaten again and forced to eat a transcript of his Independence Day speech. He was never seen nor heard from again. For 4 weeks, no news of Lumumba came out of Katanga. Finally, on February 13th, Shombe issued an obviously false statement concerning Lumumba's death. The world reacted in shock and outrage. Although the Western government saw Lumumba as a communist, to the people of the world, he was, and still is, seen as a nationalist, a hero, and after February 13th, a martyr. It is widely believed he had been killed on the evening of his arrival in Elizabethville by a firing squad commanded by Belgian officers. His body was never recovered. The remains were hacked into pieces, dissolved in acid, and burned. Without Lumumba, the Congo lapsed into a deadly civil war. Ultimately, power passed into the hands of the bloody dictator, Colonel Joseph Mobutu, who ruled by fear and violence. While Lumumba's errors played a large role in the collapse of the Congo, they were minor when compared to the actions of Belgium and the inactions of the United Nations. Lumumba played a vital role in securing Congolese independence. He was still the single strongest force of unity in the Congo. He was crucial in uniting the Congolese people enough to force the Belgians to the bargaining table at Brussels in 1960, and his leadership carried the Congo through the forced public mutinies. Today, as the Congo holds its first election since those of 1960, and as Africa struggles under the yoke of poverty and oppression, he is remembered as the embodiment of hope, unity, and the glory that should belong to Africa. His last letter, written shortly before his death, concluded, "Africa will write its own history, and to the north and south of the Sahara, it will be a glorious and dignified history. I know that my country, which is suffering so much, will know how to defend its independence and its liberty. Long live the Congo, long live Africa."
Question of the day in today's podcast is titled Julia Clarice Brown, MLK, Reparations and Black Billionaires. The question of the day is, if you care to answer it, was Martin Luther King an extortionist? Was MLK, Martin Luther King Jr., an extortionist? Here's Julia Clarice Brown.
Well, I say it is frightening, and it should be frightened to the entire American people that he has demanded $10 billion. And if he doesn't get it, then there may be riots this summer. Martin Luther King is nothing but a blackmailer, and he should be arrested for blackmailing because he certainly has blackmailed the United States government.
There's one thing that bothers me, and that, as a Negro yourself, why do you talk so bitterly against Martin Luther King and a lot of these other people of your race?
Well, let me tell you something. I don't put my race before I do my country. Being a Negro woman doesn't matter to me who is a Negro or who is a white person. If they are enemies of our country, then they are certainly my enemies too.
Turning now to pioneering businesswoman, philanthropist, and pro sports team owner, that's Sheila Johnson. She is part owner of the NHL's Washington Capitals, the NBA's Washington Wizards, and has a stake in the Washington Mystics of the WNBA.
Oh, let me put this out there too. All right, Julia Clarice Brown said, well, you heard what she just said, that Martin Luther King was basically was trying to blackmail the United States. And that was in regards to reparations. So let me ask you this. I'm about to play Sheila Johnson. Sheila Johnson is the first American black woman to become a billionaire, even before Oprah. Okay. So let's listen to her, because Sheila Johnson, Sheila Johnson, who you're going to see her, you know, her track record, she became a billionaire with no reparations check.
Turning now to pioneering businesswoman, philanthropist, and pro sports team owner, that's Sheila Johnson. She is part owner of the NHL's Washington Capitals, the NBA's Washington Wizards, and has a stake in the Washington Mystics of the WNBA. You go, Sheila. Johnson, who co-founded BET, was recently named CEO of the Year by Washington Business Journal, and she owns five-star resorts around the world. She is a badass. CBS Saturday Morning Close, that's Michelle Miller, spoke with Johnson about how she became the first black female billionaire and the personal challenges she overcame along the way.
Go Caps!
When it comes to the Washington Capitol, Sheila Johnson's what you call a proud vocal partner.
Did you ever see yourself as a professional sports mogul?
No, I wouldn't call myself a mogul.
Still, the 2018 Stanley Cup champ scored an ultimate trifecta for her.
I know when things are going to work and when they're not going to work. I really trust my instincts.
Making Johnson the first and only black woman with an ownership stake in three professional sports teams.
I have the wonderful WNBA National Champions 2019 Washington Mystics.
Drop the mic.
I have the Wizards, which we're still working on for a title. And then we have the 2018 NHL Capitals.
And how does that fit in?
It's my side gig. It's my side gig.
Her story begins in Maywood, Illinois. Her mother, an accountant. Her father, one of only 11 black neurosurgeons in the country.
You talk about learning resilience. We had to move 13 times because my father could not practice in white hospitals. And everyone asked me, you know, moving that much, what was your childhood like? And I thought it was an adventure.
Her first act in life was as a concert violinist. But it was in 1980 that Johnson took the first step in building an empire when she co-founded BET along with her ex-husband.
Talk about those early days. What was your vision?
The whole purpose of starting BET was to give the African Americans a voice. It was the birth of cable. And everything that was being pumped out there from CNN to Nickelodeon, you name it, nobody talked about the importance of the African American voice. If I could do it all over again, my voice could be listened to. I think the network would have looked a little different.
More news, less entertainment. But by 2001, the network sold to Viacom and cemented Johnson in history as the first black woman billionaire.
You don't like that title.
I don't like it.
Why?
Money's not everything. It's how you use what you have to make things work and make your life work.
Her life took a turn when she divorced in 2002, a pivotal moment where she realized she lost herself in her marriage.
You didn't kind of withdraw into the shadows and take on their identity. And one of the biggest lessons I've learned in life was that shouldn't have happened. I lost sight of who I really was.
You emerged after the divorce.
It took me 2 years, but I figured out finally who I was. It was like a rebirth.
Shortly after, she remarried, and that rebirth became the jumping-off point for her hospitality empire that now includes everything from a PGA golf course to resorts around the world, including the Salamander in Middleburg, Virginia, a place she now calls home.
It's buzzing.
She had this idea.
Betsy Davis has lived in Middleburg her whole life and says since the opening of the resort in 2005, this area has seen a growth in business by almost 70%.
There's a difference in thriving and surviving, and we will always survive, but this energy that's helped us to really thrive.
A stone's throw from Horse Country is the nation's capital and a cause close to the longtime equestrian, creating a better life for police horses.
The living conditions of these horses was unbelievable. We saw rats in the grain areas where, you know, they get their food.
You could see the desperation in their eyes. And they had been in those weeds since 1976 with the purpose that they were going to get a new home, but it never happened.
And she did.
On the left here is where the...
By helping to raise over $22 million to build these new stables.
People don't realize, yeah, you've got the nation's living room here, but this living room has to be protected.
Using her empire to give back is at the core of Johnson's work, a far cry from the little girl whose childhood dream was to take the classical music scene by storm.
My mother always told me to never say can't. She hated that word, that you can't do something. And I think especially for young women, they need to find out who they are first.
And this is a very important path.
Mm-hmm. Johnson says she's now in her third act and is the happiest she's ever been.
I don't regret anything that has happened to me personally or anything because I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. And everything that happened to me has made me who I am now.
And it's been a big year for Johnson. She acquired the prestigious Mandarin Oriental Hotel here in Washington, and she might be adding another sports team or two to her roster. Both the Washington Nationals, the baseball team, and the Commanders, the football team, could be up for sale by the end of this year. And she and her partners, they're high up on the list of potential buyers.
Another
Nate,
sports
right?
Wow.
Michelle.
Wow. How about that, Michelle?
Michelle, you captured her beautifully. Listen,
yeah.
I have such admiration for her. She is such a badass, and she is such a class act. So we know it seems the divorce certainly was very difficult for her, but she came back with a vengeance. She found new love. She's now a huge, huge force in the business industry. You really did her justice. So
thank
nice
you.
Again.
I mean, she's transparent and
yes.
humble. You know, you don't find many humble multimillionaires out there, but she's one of them.
Oh, man, she's awesome.
Yeah, well done, Michelle.
All right, today's podcast, once again, is titled Julia Clarice Brown, MLK, Reparations and Black Billionaires, and we just heard from a black billionaire. Now, I'm going to play a clip, and I played it earlier in the podcast today. It's not long. You're going to get a soundbite from Julia Clarice Brown, who was a black woman. I don't think she's living anymore. But she said something, and this is in reference to reparations and MLK, Martin Luther King. So I want you to hear it because this is, we're trying to tie all this in. Once again, the title of today's podcast is Julia Clarice Brown, MLK, Martin Luther King, Reparations and Black Billionaires. So, oh, let me get Julia lined up here. Where is she? All right, here we go.
Hear ye, the court's in session.
Oh, wrong one. Okay, here we go.
Well, I say it is frightening, and it should be frightened to the entire American people that he has demanded $10 billion. And if he doesn't get it, then there may be riots this summer. Martin Luther King is nothing but a blackmailer, and he should be arrested for blackmailing because he certainly has blackmailed the United States government.
There's one thing that bothers me, and that, as a Negro yourself, why do you talk so bitterly against Martin Luther King and a lot of these other people of your race?
Well, let me tell you something. I don't put my race before I do my country. Being a Negro woman doesn't matter to me who is a Negro or who is a white person. If they are enemies of our country, then they are certainly my enemies too.
Okay, that was Julia Clarice Brown. And she was giving her response to Martin Luther King stating, and I guess he was, it's interpreted that he was asking for reparations when he said, we've come to get our check. $10 billion in reparations at the time that he was asking. And Julia, a black woman, Julia Clarice Brown, disagreed with that. Now, the next clip, I'm going to replay, and that's one of my questions today. Was Martin Luther King an extortionist, a blackmailer? Did he try to blackmail the United States government into paying reparations? Question. Now, and I want that figure, $10 billion that she put out there. Now, the next clip that I'm about to replay again features Sheila Johnson. Sheila Johnson is the first, before Oprah people, the first black female billionaire, American billionaire, and she's still living, is Sheila Johnson. She and her husband got in on the cable business via Black Entertainment Television, BET, and then she got into owning sports franchises. She's still on sports franchises. But she's probably worth $10 billion herself. So listen to her, because this is a woman who became a billionaire, a black woman, a black American woman, still living, who became a billionaire, first generation, and she didn't get a reparations check. So if she can do it without the government's help, why can't anybody else?
Turning now to pioneering businesswoman, philanthropist, and pro sports team owner, that's Sheila Johnson. She is part owner of the NHL's Washington Capitals, the NBA's Washington Wizards, and has a stake in the Washington Mystics of the WNBA. You go, Sheila. Johnson, who co-founded BET, was recently named CEO of the Year by Washington Business Journal, and she owns five-star resorts around the world. She is a badass. CBS Saturday Morning Co-host, that's Michelle Miller, spoke with Johnson about how she became the first black female billionaire and the personal challenges she overcame along the way.
Go Caps!
When it comes to the Washington Capitals, Sheila Johnson's what you call a proud vocal partner.
Woo-hoo!
Did you ever see yourself as a professional sports mogul?
No, I wouldn't call myself a mogul.
Still, the 2018 Stanley Cup champ scored an ultimate trifecta for her.
I know when things are going to work and when they're not going to work. I really trust my instinct.
Making Johnson the first and only black woman with an ownership stake in three professional sports teams.
I have the wonderful WNBA National Champions 2019 Washington Mystics.
Drop the mic.
I have the Wizards, which we're still working on for a title. And then we have the 2018 NHL Capitals.
And how does that fit in?
It's my side gig. It's my side gig.
Her story begins in Maywood, Illinois. Her mother, an accountant, her father, one of only 11 black neurosurgeons in the country.
You talk about learning resilience. We had to move 13 times because my father could not practice in white hospitals. And everyone asked me, you know, moving that much, what was your childhood like? I thought it was an adventure.
Her first act in life was as a concert violinist. But it was in 1980 that Johnson took the first step in building an empire when she co-founded BET along with her ex-husband.
Talk about those early days. What was your vision?
The whole purpose of starting BET was to give the African Americans a voice. It was the birth of cable. And everything that was being pumped out there from CNN to Nickelodeon, you name it, nobody talked about the importance of the African American voice. If I could do it all over again, my voice could be listened to, I think the network would have looked a little different.
More news, less entertainment. But by 2001, the network sold to Viacom and cemented Johnson in history as the first black woman billionaire.
You don't like that title.
I don't like it.
Why?
Money's not everything. It's how you use what you have to make things work and make your life work.
Her life took a turn when she divorced in 2002, a pivotal moment where she realized she lost herself in her marriage.
You didn't kind of withdraw into the shadows and take on their identity. And one of the biggest lessons I've learned in life was that shouldn't have happened. I lost sight of who I really was.
You emerged after the divorce.
It took me 2 years, but I figured out finally who I was. It was like a rebirth.
Shortly after, she remarried, and that rebirth became the jumping-off point for her hospitality empire that now includes everything from a PGA golf course to resorts around the world, including the Salamander in Middleburg, Virginia, a place she now calls home.
It's buzzing.
She had this idea.
Betsy Davis has lived in Middleburg her whole life and says since the opening of the resort in 2005, this area has seen a growth in business by almost 70%.
It is a difference in thriving and surviving, and we will always survive, but this energy that's helped us to really thrive.
A stone's throw from horse country is the nation's capital and a cause close to the longtime equestrian, creating a better life for police horses.
The living conditions of these horses was unbelievable. We saw rats in the grain areas where, you know, they get their food.
You could see the desperation in their eyes. And they had been in those weeds since 1976 with the purpose that they were going to get a new home, but it never happened.
And she did.
The left here is where the...
By helping to raise over $22 million to build these new stables.
People don't realize, yeah, you've got the nation's living room here, but this living room has to be protected.
Using her empire to give back is at the core of Johnson's work. A far cry from the little girl whose childhood dream was to take the classical music scene by storm.
My mother always told me to never say can't. She hated that word, that you can't do something. And I think especially for young women, they need to find out who they are first.
And this is a very important path.
Mm-hmm. Johnson says she's now in her third act and is the happiest she's ever been.
I don't regret anything that has happened to me personally or anything, because I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. And everything that happened to me has made me who I am now.
And it's been a big year for Johnson. She acquired the prestigious Mandarin Oriental Hotel here in Washington, and she might be adding another sports team or two to her roster. Both the Washington Nationals, the baseball team, and the Commanders, the football team, could be up for sale by the end of this year. And she and her partners, they're high up on the list of potential buyers.
Another
Nate,
course.
Right?
Wow.
Michelle.
Wow. How about that, Michelle?
Michelle, you captured her beautifully. Listen, yeah. I have such admiration for her. She is such a badass, and she is such a class act. So we know it seems the divorce certainly was very difficult for her, but she came back with a vengeance. She found new love. She's now a huge, huge force in the business industry. You really did her justice. So
thank you.
Done.
I mean, she's transparent and
yes.
humble. You know, you don't find many humble multimillionaires out there, but she's one of them.
Oh, man, she's awesome.
Yeah, well done, Michelle.
All right, so MLK now, of course, MLK has been gone for quite a while now. But there are people that still want reparations. Okay, there's people that want reparations. So that's why I played Julia Clarice Brown, because that's what she said when King was alive. And you look at a person, because Sheila Johnson is like 74 years old right now. Her net worth is over $600 million. She controls over $1 billion in assets. And she's first-generation billionaire. LeBron James, who recently broke Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's NBA scoring record, all-time leading scorer in the NBA, he's worth $1 billion with a high school diploma. He never attended not one second of college. Now, his kids are going to college, but he never attended college. He's a billionaire from just playing basketball. No reparations for him, no special government handouts for him. Once again, first-generation wealth, uber wealth in sports. Sheila Johnson didn't play any sports. She helped her first husband. They founded, you know, cable, Black Entertainment Television, BET. Two examples. So, my question is, I mean, because you have some people that have, I don't know what year Martin Luther King said, we've come to get our check. I don't know what year that was, but you got quite a few people that have been around since then that are still alive. Some have passed on, but they're still waiting to get a check, a reparations check, from the government. Whereas people like LeBron, Sheila James, Aliko Dangote, he's in Nigeria, so let's just keep him on the continent. But Barack Obama, President of the United States twice. You got Kamala Harris, Vice President of the United States right now. You got a whole bunch, and these people are wealthy. Kamala Harris did not get to where she got to right now. Barack Obama did not become the President of the United States at the Social Services Office. I'm not knocking the Social Services Office. I'm just saying. The entitlement programs, the government programs, these people, they didn't get on to it. I believe in, now, you know, if you believe in reparations, and we look at that word reparations, you know, the root of it is repair. You can repair yourself. That's my thinking. I'm just one person out of the 8 billion on the planet. But you can repair yourself. Obama, President Obama, repaired himself by running for president. You know, well, if he either won or didn't, but he won. That's what I call DIY, do-it-yourself reparations. Sheila Johnson, along with her first husband, Robert Johnson, Bob Johnson, as he also known as, they repaired themselves by, you know, getting in on a cable game, cable television game early, and, you know, forming Black Entertainment Television. Because when they first started, BET was probably on in those early days, probably for maybe 2 hours a week, 2 or 3 hours a week. That's it. Then it grew to what it is today. LeBron James, born to a teenage mother, did not attend college, went from high school. Now, this isn't an American success story. Went from high school to a professional career to becoming a millionaire to becoming worth a billion. Black man. First generation millionaire, first generation worth a billionaire, you know, billionaire status. Now, those, we're talking about, let's see, LeBron James Sports, Sheila Johnson, cable television pioneer. Now she owns hotels and resorts, and she owns other sports teams. Some people are, you know what, good luck to, you know what, I don't know if you guys will ever get that reparations check from the government, but I like the path that of some of the people I just named. And, in my opinion, repaired themselves. You cannot rely on anybody, particularly the government, to repair you. You've got to fix you. Anyway, what are your thoughts on Clarice, Julia Clarice Brown? What are your thoughts on what she said about Martin Luther King in response to him coming to Washington and, we've come to get our check. And some people put that check at the time he said it, $10 billion in reparations. Do you co-sign what Julia Clarice Brown said in light of Sheila Johnson, LeBron James, Kamala Harris, Barack Obama? If you look at the Black Enterprise top 100 industrial companies, there's about another 5 or 6 companies on that are billion-dollar companies. None of these individual people that I just named, including the companies that are in the Black Enterprise top 100 industrial companies, none of those companies received a check from the government. So was Julia Clarice Brown. What's your take on it? I'm going to play her again. 619-768-2945. Was she correct, or what do you think?
Well, I say it is frightening, and it should be frightened to the entire American people that he has demanded $10 billion. And if he doesn't get it, then there may be riots this summer. Martin Luther King is nothing but a blackmailer, and he should be arrested for blackmailing because he certainly has blackmailed the United States government.
There's one thing that bothers me, and that, as a Negro yourself, why do you talk so bitterly against Martin Luther King and a lot of these other people of your race?
Well, let me tell you something. I don't put my race before I do my country. Being a Negro woman doesn't matter to me who is a Negro or who is a white person. If they are enemies of our country, then they are certainly my enemies too.
Okay, that was Julia Clarice Brown, a black woman, an African-American woman. Controversial statements then, and it's probably controversial today. but she was making a comment towards Martin Luther King and his thing when he came to, you know, you've come to get our $10 billion check. That's in reference to reparations, but that's why I played the Sheila Johnson thing. Sheila Johnson, she's 74 years old right now. Her net worth is over $600 million. That's over $500 million. She controls over $500 million in assets. She owns sports teams. She owns hotels. I mean, luxury hotels. She owns resorts. She and her first husband, Robert Johnson, also known as Bob Johnson, they were pioneers in the cable TV industry when they put together Black Entertainment Television. He's a billionaire. She's a mayor. Forget about Oprah. Sheila Johnson, and hardly anybody talks about Sheila Johnson. We have to do something on her one day, that just for her. But she's the first African-American female billionaire. But she did it without government assistance. You know, she didn't get a check. And then, as I stated earlier today, LeBron James, basketball player, just became the leading all-time scorer in the National Basketball Association when he broke Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's all-time leading score. And I think Jabbar's record stayed. Man, that's been up there. I mean, nobody touched it for like 20 years or so. Could be more than that. Now, of course, LeBron came right out of high school, and Jabbar, he went to college for 4 years, so we're not counting that. But in any event, so here's LeBron James, a black high school kid born to a teenage mother. He really doesn't know who his biological dad is to this day, not for certain. He's worth a billion. No reparations check for him. Sheila Johnson, you heard her backstory in her own words. Kamala Harris, well, her parents were basically immigrants, really. Mother Indian, father Jamaican. She's currently the Vice President of the United States. And you've got, it's kind of, we'd be here for the rest of the day and to the end of this year talking about accomplishments with first generation millionaires. But the billionaire club is very special. So my question, I mean, what are your thoughts on Julia Clarice Brown's thoughts about Martin Luther King? I thought it was a little bit excessive. He's gone now anyway. I don't think he needed to be locked up or anything like that. But if it was done, if you look at the definition of the word extortion, okay, now he didn't extort the American government or like that, but there have been other people, I'm not going to name their names, there have been other people who have shaken down corporate American companies that, you know, if you don't do this, that, or the other, which translates into make a donation to our nonprofit, we're going to march and protest you. So what some of those Fortune 500 companies did is, that's how you got, there are two civil rights leaders that are still in circulation today that they, in my opinion, I'm using the word, they shook down. I'm not going to say extort, because extortion is a criminal act, but they shook down corporate entities. And that helped bankroll their. And I'm not going to name any names, but these people started out with darshikis. Now they're wearing Brooks Brothers suits. So do your homework on that. I'm not naming names on that. But anyway, Julia Clarice Brown, I would call her probably an obscure figure in American history or American black history. But hey, man, my hat, so you know what? My hat, and I guess I'm prejudiced with this, my hat is off to the Sheila Johnsons, a woman who, black woman, who got together with her husband, Bob Johnson, and they saw the opportunity of cable television, and they took a chance on it. They couldn't have gone to the government because the government doesn't bankroll anything like that. The Social Services Office doesn't bankroll anything like that. They took a chance on it as pioneers. They created BET, Black Entertainment Television, and they became, they're both billionaires now. They're divorced from each other, but they're probably still civil and cordial. But we're talking about first-generation billionaires, and they're less than, there are 8 billion people on the planet, they're less than 4,000 they're less than 4,000 billionaires on the planet at all. And they're, you know, I got to count, do a count. I don't even think there are 50 black billionaires on the planet. I mean, just the overall number is small. The overall number is less than 4,000. That's everybody. And the wealthiest black billionaire on the planet is Aliko Dangote, who lives in Nigeria. He's a Nigerian billionaire. First generation, by the way. Okay, so... And then LeBron James. If that is not an American success story, LeBron James, here's a black guy. Oh, you know, when he came out of high school, a black kid, 17, 18 years old, becomes a millionaire by playing basketball. No college degree. Born to a teenage mother. Now, he's worth a billion. Interesting that, now, you guys can find it. Send a clip to me. I haven't heard any of these people. Sheila Johnson, Bob Johnson, Barack Obama, Kamala Harris, LeBron James. I haven't heard any of them talk about, you know, getting a reparations check from the government. Now, once again, you can get reparations in several ways because at the root, once again, reparations means repair. You can repair yourself. You can repair yourself, and you can help repair other people that's in your family. I'm just saying, for those of you who really believe in reparations, you can wait on the government side. Matter of fact, it's 2023. The March on Washington was in 1963. That's 60 years ago. There are some people that were at that march that are still living, and they're still waiting to get their check. Meanwhile, Barack Obama and his family, they repaired themselves. Kamala Harris repaired herself. LeBron James repaired himself. He's the only athlete and entertainer I've named out of the names that I've named so far. And then Sheila Johnson, her first husband, Bob Johnson, they repaired themselves. Anyway, your thoughts on what's her name? Julia Clarice Brown. An interesting and probably an obscure figure in Black history, particularly towards her specific comments on MLK. Like I said, I think she's a little bit extreme. No, he didn't need to arrest him or nothing like that, although he did get arrested but for other things, but not that. But anyway, let me see. Let me find my way back to my studio here. 619-768-2945. That's the number to call in. And then that's one of the things we're preaching on here, man. Repair yourself. Fridays we have Delmar America. He'll be in with, you know, if you want to learn how to repair yourself on a family level, he'll be here to talk about that. Okay, 609. 309, your mic is open.
Good morning, L.A.
Good morning, Chris, and how are you?
I'm good. You know, yeah, as far as that question earlier, I would say that was a little harsh. I mean, you know, for standing up for human rights, one thing I liked about what she said, because it's what I say, we're the human race. Doesn't matter, but she talks about America, country. She
right.
didn't talk about the rest of the world. She didn't talk worldwide. And the thing is we all come from around the world. I think that's what the whole meaning of what this is supposed to be about and what we're supposed to get out of it is by us coming from wherever we are, we're able to come together. We can come together anywhere on this planet. It doesn't matter who and what your nationality is, because we have that ability. But now do we do it? And what do we do when we do it?
Right.
This can be that reparation as we're in a preparation. Setting out with a resolution, giving the world a solution, and letting them know that you, the human being that's hearing this voice, is the answer. You are a part. What part it is, it's big or small. All of us have a different one to do. But I hope this is giving you a clue. It takes all of us to do something. But there was something said there, and, you know, people have their ways, you know. She was kind of in an aggressive conversation right there. And
right, yeah.
So, you know, when you're in the defense, that changes perception of outcome of of what's going on. So, you know, she had a nice way of coming back at it, but, you know, at the same time she was passing judgment. She was saying what should happen. And it shouldn't be us saying what should happen. It should be that we're doing something and making it happen and seeing what has happened. But don't point a finger and not get involved to fix the problem. Because if you use your fingers, you can point them. Well, why point a finger at somebody? You know how many of them point back at you? Now,
the rest of your fingers.
Yeah, three pointing back at you at least, and that thumb's trying to.
Right.
But it comes down, you know, we use our fingers, you know, people throw up the middle finger. Don't even know your name, but by an action you made, they threw up the middle finger. Now, the people that are out there and they try to get their voices heard and their opinions, you know, into what we're supposed to see and believe. You know, there is an ulterior motive when evil is at hand. when greed is over the need. Now, I'm not in any way ashamed to say that I'm proud of Martin Luther King, because the one thing is able to happen is people can say his name right now and have meaning behind it. Care about a man that they never met, never seen, but it was because he believed in more than himself. And he put himself in harm's way. And there's a lot of us out there that do. But we want you to not be in harm's way. That's why we're doing what we do. And, you know, his voice can't make new words. But it's time for the billion human march. Now, that means it's bigger than the USA, because there's nobody here that don't come from far away. Let's see your action. You want your reparation? Get ready, because there's so much you have no clue. There's more money that will come back to you. There's 200% more money than we all split, and 10%'s got 90%. But there's 20%. You figure it out, and it'll show you that every dime of that can come back to you. It's here. I need you guys to get it on. That's the new song. Come up with one. Share it with this podcast. We'll play it. I want to see your actions, because it's going to be the reaction of your action. People will be able to see something. They'll be able, if you're sharing a message, share this. Share this podcast, because everybody needs to be on here. Where are your voices? There, you all have one. Share yours with me. I'll scream right beside you just to excite you. There's one of my little poem things in one of my poems. But this ain't about a poem. This is about action. We're talking about reparation. Do I believe the human race has done right? No, I think it's been a big disgrace. But let's take the diss out of that. That's our new little slogan. We're going to put it on some shirts, and you need to know that. Take the diss out of that. Come on. Disgrace, discouragement, dishonor, disable. Come on. Everybody's struggle needs to be everybody's struggle. That's the message. It's not just one person's struggle. All of us, if we do this, there's a lot of people ain't struggling for nothing. We've talked about it right here. I've heard it today. So you want me to come on here and have some words to say? I say let's make some action. I've put out a challenge. And there's been a few. But I haven't been called into that city and done what I asked. Prepare, get a package so I can bring it, right? That ain't happened. No one's bought a package. So when there's a challenge put out, or a goal set, I don't give up. I don't quit. It will not be my fault that something doesn't get finished, because I won't give up. And it doesn't matter about the money. It's about get what I agreed to do done. But, you know, this is what I do when I'm alone. This is who I am. This is who I am when I'm with someone, because I'll be encouraging them to help me get this done, or not necessarily. I don't ask in that way. Normally, I'm trying to pay. I want you to come up. And if there's money to be made, there's money made. And it ain't going to one. It's going to all. So 90% of us have 10% of the money. 10% have 90% of the money. But we got a way to start grabbing it and pulling back 20% every day. But it takes you to make an action.
Yeah.
You know,
and
we
can take
an action that gives you something.
Right, right. It, some examples of that would be in this country where it's visible, the Amish and the Mennonite, they have their communities where they manufacture things, and they have a very good economy. And then Booker T. Washington, when he was alive, that's how they got Tuskegee Institute off the ground. They were making their they learned how to make bricks. That's those early buildings. You had students at Tuskegee that actually built those. They didn't know anything about construction of building, but they learned how to make bricks. They learned how to make nails, and they ended up selling those. They were manufacturing those two items, probably more. And then as a country, on a countrywide level or cultural level, in China at time at one time was a very poor country on the global scene. Now they're number one when it comes to manufacturing. So I would say the best tool that I can see, more than the government, when we're talking about the word reparations, is find something to make and make it. It could be like Mignon Francois that we played on here a few times. Her thing, she makes cupcakes. That was her reparations. Tuskegee Institute in the early days when Booker T. Washington was still alive, they made bricks and they made nails. That's what helped finance the early stages of that institution. It's now Tuskegee University. Like I say, if you go on any search engine and type in Amish community maps or Amish settlement maps, you'll see where they are in the United States as well as globally. And also if you type in Mennonite maps, and you'll see where they are globally. So it's I think the quickest way to heal up any situation, regardless of race, creed, color, religion, or whatever, is find something and make it. It could be a house. It could be a shed. Could be a tree house on stilts. Could be a quilt. Could be bedding, clothes. But find something that you like and make it. And I think that's probably the best way to repair, or at least help repair, whatever anybody's going towards or whatever. So now, Chris, now you're looking at 50 cities, and but we're looking for the first people that will put the feet to the talking. It's February, almost mid-February, so like we need to get some out there before the end of this month, because, or actually before the middle of this month. We're almost at the middle of this month, because when March 1st hits and the weather starts getting nice again, people forget about the goals that they put out, you know, in January. So, let's go through the process here with you now. If, let's say, I think you mentioned yesterday, $4,000 could help a person get the frame of a building?
Yes.
Okay. So now, how is that, the $4,000, lump sum payment up front, payment plans, financing, how do you have that arranged?
That's material. You buy it, and it's on its way.
Okay.
It needs to be a COD at least, you know what I mean? Or have the financing for it. just whatever. But yeah, it needs to be paid for. It's material.
They still have COD, cash on delivery.
Yeah, they can do cash on delivery, but I would want some kind
of. All right,
of,
I don't know if they still
security.
Have it. Okay. All right. Today,
I mean, I've got to buy material just to make it. So.
Right, that's true. All right, so today's Wednesday. So, give us a run through on, what you know on, because like so you've got to make. You got to get some money to basically put things together. So what minimum deposit?
Minimum deposit, I would say $1,500.
Okay, $1,500. That's not a whole lot of money.
$3,000 on delivery.
Okay,
but
now so let's say the day
that covers me to get it delivered.
Right. So $1,500, and then. They need to have the balance of that upon delivery. Now, it's Wednesday. Today's Wednesday, so they need to have the balance of that money by what day? Today's Wednesday.
I would say it would be within a 14-day period, the material can be made and shipped anywhere in the country.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, that's a reasonable amount of time. All right, $1,500. Right. It all depends on where they are.
Right. All depends on where they are. I mean.
Okay, $1,500. And the materials we're talking about, a metal building, correct?
Metal frame. Yes. It'll look like a 2x4 or a 2x6 or a 2x8. Yeah. That's the dimension. So. It's the same thing as using wood, but you have a track on top, and you have a track on the bottom. You put the studs in, and you put a screw in. You do the same with the trusses. You just lay them out on top of the walls that you just built and build your trusses. Then you take the screws out of the track, and then they stand the walls up.
Now, you mentioned that like an erector set. So we can take,
yep.
Let's say we put the building up, but let's say it's in a wooded area, you know, you don't have a groundskeeper there on a regular. So, A, how long would it take to assemble it? B, how long would it take to disassemble it? Because, you know, when nobody's there, they might want to put it in storage.
Well, I know that I had 4 people assemble one, and we were roughly there for 2.5 hours. The kids did most of the work.
Not bad.
They put,
mm-hmm.
So they put the frame together. Then I came back over, and with me and 2 guys, we stood it up. Now, it took us 2 hours to stand it up, but this thing was 10 foot tall, and it had 6-foot trusses on it. So it was 16 feet in the air.
Now, that's what, how many people? How many people now for that? The sand
there was 3 of us.
3 of them. Okay, 3. What if you had 9 people? How long do you think it would have taken?
An hour.
I mean to stand it up.
An hour. Oh, no, to stand it up.
Oh, 1 hour, okay.
No, I mean an hour. They'd build the whole thing and stand it up.
Oh, got it. All right, 9 people. All right. Hey, 15, that's not bad. That's.
And even if it took them 2 hours to do it.
All that would be done. Right, okay.
How about 9 people?
All right, so.
If they was getting $20 an hour, that's $180.
All right, all doable numbers. All right, now let's see. In Florida, you've got, we got people on the ground here. Let's see. There's Viana and her tiny apartment in Orlando. There's Awesome Alice. Oh, you know what? I was supposed to call her. Matter of fact, hold it. Awesome Alice, she lives in Florida. There's another one. You mentioned her name yesterday.
Miss Hershey, she lives in Florida.
Miss Hershey.
Yeah.
Let me see. Miss, did I? Okay, Miss Hershey. I mean, Miss Hershey's about an hour away from me. And then you got Awesome Alice. All right, that's about 4 hours away from me. I'm gonna see what I can organize between here and then I'm gonna see if I can get Reba's from Chicago. So by this time tomorrow morning we can have at least a team together that can put together something solid on the ground by this time. Tomorrow morning. So that's my homework assignment between now and tomorrow morning. So, because I don't want this month to get away. Let's see. Chris, any other announcements? Or anybody out there?
I mean, there's all kinds of things people need to know about, whether they've heard about it or not. You know, get involved in your community, get your kids involved, and let's get the hunger ended. You know, you can get greenhouses, too. You don't have to just get a house. You can get something that can feed you and bring in money.
Right.
It can feed the people, you know. So if you want a sustainable community, you can have it. 100%, you can have it off the grid. It's totally up to you guys what you want to do, what you want to see, how you want to get there. It's more, let's make this year amazing. Let's do some things that we've never thought we could do. People never dreamed that it could be done. But guess what? Those dreams are just a reality. It needs to happen, you know, or hasn't happened yet. But by us doing something, we can make it happen. So, no, we're good, I think.
I'm going to put a call in to Awesome Alice and Miss Hershey. Get them on here tomorrow morning so we can, and I'm going to call Reba, too, so we can nail some things down concrete so we can organize this money and put deadlines on, because once that money's out there, you got to perform. So thank you, Chris. Thank you, everybody, for listening. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.